You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a nationwide survey of 400 school resource officers found that 20% did not think their schools were ready for a school shooting. We'll find out what police officers in schools say they need to help keep students safe. First, public sector labor unions were handed a significant setback today. In a 5-4 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court said that unions cannot force non-members to pay union dues. That overturns a 1977 decision that said requiring non-members to help defray the cost of collective bargaining prevents freeloading and ensures labor peace. The case that was ruled on today centered on an employee from Illinois named Mark Janis. He sued his AFSCME union, arguing that he shouldn't have to pay dues to support positions he opposes. The ruling affects about 5 million workers in 22 states. Most public employee unions in Wisconsin won't be affected because Act 10 had already limited their ability to collect those dues. Public safety unions, including police and fire, were exempted from Act 10, so they will be affected by the ruling. Also today, Justice Anthony Kennedy announced he's retiring from the court next month, giving President Trump an opportunity to solidify the conservative wing of the court.
We will begin our search for a new justice of the United States Supreme Court that will begin immediately. And hopefully we're going to pick somebody who will be as outstanding.
Richard Wolff is a U.S. Supreme Court correspondent for USA Today. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
We had called you originally about this labor ruling. We'll spend most of our time on that, but I want to hear from you on Justice Kennedy's retirement. There was speculation, but I think it still came as a surprise to a lot of people.
Well, you know, it's been speculated upon for a couple of years now. A lot of people thought that he would retire last year at the end of the term, and he did not. There was simply no word whatsoever from him. This term, oddly enough, I think fewer people were expecting him to retire. And lo and behold, and then we were all waiting on tenterhooks this morning because it was possible that it would be announced as part and parcel of the end of the term's final decisions, et cetera. Nothing happened then. And then a couple of hours later came the announcement that he had sent a letter, that he had hand-delivered a letter, as a matter of fact, to President Trump announcing his retirement after 30 years. So not totally a surprise, but we never really knew when to expect it. And so now the process begins.
How big a difference could a Trump appointee be on the court, whoever ends up replacing Justice Kennedy?
Well, the first answer is huge. It's not nearly as big a difference, say, as 1991, when President George H.W. Bush got to replace Justice Marshall with Clarence Thomas. That was a complete flip from a very liberal to a very conservative justice. It's more like 2006. When Justice Sandra Day O'Connor retired and President Bush was able to nominate Justice Samuel Alito, that was replacing a somewhat moderate swing vote, albeit someone who was a Republican president's nominee, to someone who was more solidly conservative. And I think you could compare what's about to happen almost exactly to what happened in 2006. I should add, however, that Justice Kennedy this year, this term, was very solidly with the conservatives, the other four conservatives, in almost all of the important cases right through to today. So, you know, if you looked at, you know, how would this term have been any different, it probably wouldn't have been any different. The difference comes on issues such as same-sex marriage, which, you know, you can translate into a lot of other gay rights issues, abortion, to some degree affirmative action. Some of the social issues where Justice Kennedy has lined up with liberals. And 2 and 3 years ago, he was more often with the liberals on those types of cases than with the conservatives. So that would be the biggest change. The question is, can President Trump get a very conservative, capital V, very conservative nominee through the Senate with only 51 Republicans? And that includes the ailing John McCain. Without him, it would be 50-plus Vice President Pence. So I don't think he can go with somebody who is seen by, say, some of the more moderate Republican senators, there are a couple of those left, as extremely conservative. But most of the people on his list of 25 potential nominees probably would pass muster with all the Republicans in the Senate.
Talking to Richard Wolff, U.S. Supreme Court correspondent for USA Today. We'll be watching that story play out in the months to come. Richard, let's look at this ruling we originally called you about, came out this morning. How big a difference is this going to be for public employee unions?
Well, at first blush, it looks terrible. The question is, and I can't answer this part of it, is what the unions do to try to make it more palatable. What basically happened, and this was expected, is the court ruled that public employee unions can't collect what's called agency shop or fair share fees from non-members. Those are fees that come to about 80%. It varies from state to state, but 70, 80, 90% of what union members pay in dues. And these are fees that those non-members have to pay for collective bargaining. The unions have always said, and it goes back to a 1977 Supreme Court case that said this, that you can't charge non-members for politics, for the money that you, the public employee union, spends in elections. But you can charge them for all the costs of representing them. The argument against it and the argument that carried the day with the five conservatives in the court is that these are public unions. So virtually everything they do affects the public fisc, affects public tax dollars. And therefore, even when the non-members pay for what is allegedly collective bargaining, they're helping support the unions that take positions vis-a-vis public affairs and tax money that they don't agree with. And so, if that money disappears from the public employee unions and they don't do something to replace it, it could have a big effect.
And the majority, do they argue, I guess, on free speech First Amendment grounds? That was that part of the debate here?
That was the whole thing, really, for the majority. It's compelled speech. There were other cases this year, for instance, having to do with that baker in Colorado who wouldn't bake a cake for a same-sex couple's wedding, that fell into the category of what's known as compelled speech. You're compelling these non-members to speak with their dollars. Remember, this is a Supreme Court that considers campaign spending to be speech. So they're, in essence, being forced to speak with their money by contributing to public unions that they don't want to contribute to. So it was seen as a First Amendment issue by the Republicans, and by the five conservatives on the Supreme Court. And they've been trying to get this exact type of case to the court for 6 years. There was a case in 2012, another in 2014, and another in 2016 that all moved in this direction. The first two made sort of progress toward the conservative justices' ultimate goal. And then 2 years ago, they thought it was a slam dunk that they were going to do exactly what they did today. But shortly before the case was heard, Justice Scalia died, and so they only had four votes, and ultimately it was a 4-4 tie requiring another case. That one was a California Teachers Union case. This one was out of Illinois involving a state employee, a social worker for the state. But they were finally able, the conservatives on the court were finally able to do what they had wanted to do all along, and it's very unusual and very rare that they basically say we are overruling one of our own decisions, in this case a decision called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education that dated back to 1977.
We'll leave it there for now. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
That's Richard Wolff, U.S. Supreme Court correspondent for USA Today. We talked with him about today's 5-4 ruling that says government workers who choose not to join a union cannot be required to pay union dues. Now, a recent survey conducted by the Education Week Research Center found that 1 in 5 school resource officers do not feel as though their school is prepared to deal with an active shooter situation. That was one among many findings from some 400 school resource officers, or SROs, that responded to the survey after the deadly school shootings in Parkland, Florida, and Santa Fe, Texas this spring. Evie Blod is a reporter who covers school climate and child well-being for Education Week. Evie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's start off with the really basic question. What is a school resource officer? Because I think people kind of blur the lines between that and some kind of security guard.
Yeah, it gets kind of fuzzy, actually, in how people use the term. A school resource officer is sometimes a catch-all term that schools use to describe a law enforcement officer with a badge, the authority to arrest people, who works and is stationed in its hallways. There are some folks who would say, you can be a police officer working in a school, but a school resource officer, that term should be reserved for officers who've been specifically trained to work in schools, which some police just come straight from the street to a school hallway. So it gets a little fuzzy, but we're not talking about armed guards. We're talking about actual law enforcement officers.
And this statistic that we mentioned about 1 in 5 school resource officers saying their schools, they don't think there's enough preparation for that active shooter situation. Can you talk about what kind of things you heard from officers in this survey?
Yeah, and that question wasn't whether they individually felt prepared.
Right.
It was whether their school as a whole. And, you know, some folks said, whoa, one in five, that's a lot of folks who don't feel prepared. And some folks said, well, four out of five do feel prepared. Are they a little overconfident? Because this is a very unpredictable situation. Officers told us that the most common response for what is necessary to make their school safer is better training of students and staff for how to handle violent situations, how to respond and recognize warning signs of violence. Some officers also said that they wanted to change some protocols, that they might need some more equipment, that they might need better interactions between students and adults. School safety, we think of it really narrowly after shootings, but it's really a broad concept that includes having good, healthy relationships between students and adults in schools.
Yeah, can you talk about the why of school resource officers? As you say, it's not just, we hope these people will prevent a mass shooting.
Right. Well, so it's a really complicated conversation, actually. The number of school resource officers in schools has risen steadily since the school shootings in Columbine, which really kind of sparked this movement. Most recent federal data shows that 36% of elementary schools and 65% of secondary schools have on-site school officers. And the idea is that, you know, proponents of school officers and school officer groups say, you know, not only am I serving to keep you safe, I'm also forming healthy relationships with students, and I'm also serving in an educational role, maybe in drug prevention classes and things like that. There are some civil rights groups who are concerned that not every student has a healthy relationship with law enforcement in general, and they see a conflict with putting law enforcement officers in a school's halls. You know, they worry about how that will affect things like discipline and things like that. But the idea here is that we're supposed to have sort of a community policing model happening in a school as opposed to on the street.
What did you hear from officers about their training? Because I could see anything from Officer Smith, you drew the short straw, you're in the high school this year, to somebody going through a lot of training for this very specialized role. What did they say?
Right, and there is a real spectrum of how officers feel prepared and what kind of officer schools are able to recruit. Especially right now, we have states that are really rushing to hire a lot more officers for their schools, and that creates, you know, kind of a supply and demand issue. Who's available, and are we trying to recruit experienced, qualified officers away from departments? 19% of officers who responded to our survey said that they felt like they didn't have sufficient training to work in a school environment. And officers will tell you that working in a school is very different than any other police role. You're working with children who are still developing their sense of self, their brain, their executive functioning, their ability to control their behavior. 93% said they'd been trained to respond to an active shooter, which isn't surprising, because a lot of schools really think about putting an officer in their hallways to respond to these kinds of events. About half of officers said they had not been trained to work with special education students, which would be a concern for some because special education students have unique behavioral and disciplinary concerns that I think all adults in schools would want to be aware of and respectful of.
Hot topic often is the idea of arming teachers or other staff members at school. What did these school resource officers think about that?
Well, about a third of them said that they believed it would make schools safer to arm teachers, which is not a very high number, but it aligns with what we've seen in among some other groups. You know, you survey teachers and very few of them nationally say that they want to be armed. I think school police officers that I spoke with, interviewed for my story, said, you know, we're not just someone carrying a gun. In addition to having some really advanced training in how to use a gun and how to respond to an active shooting situation, we recognize kind of the full spectrum of safety issues. I did talk to one school police officer in a rural district in Missouri who said, you know, he sees a place for it, for well-trained and screened teachers to serve as a deterrent. And I think that, you know, and a lot of times you'll hear that more often in rural schools where they worry about response time from outside law enforcement agencies in a real crisis situation.
Among the officers you interviewed, one said, there's a quote that stands with you, I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it in front of me, but I tell other officers, if you don't like kids, don't do this job. It seems obvious in a way, but talk about that.
Well, yeah, I think some people think, you know, I don't know if officers themselves would think this, but I think there's a perception that this is a job you shift on to when you, you know, you're tired of working the street beat or something like that, or, you know, some departments, you know, oftentimes school police are put in schools in cooperation with local police departments. And so sometimes local police departments might not understand that their officers need to be serving a unique role, that how different this job is than the jobs of their other officers. And so this police officer says, yeah, I mean, you're going to be dealing maybe with teenagers who can get kind of sarcastic, maybe a little confrontational, and that presents a really unique challenge. You're dealing with them in, you know, kind of their environment, in the place where we're supposed to be really supportive and helping them thrive and helping them feel safe. And that's a different environment, I think, for a lot of adults to come into, not just police, but anyone, you know. And so he says, you know, he wants officers who are ready to really build relationships with kids, to really understand who they are and what they need, beyond just being prepared for safety situations.
And briefly, did the officers point out any misconceptions that maybe parents and the public have about their role in school safety?
I think it's that idea that they are just another person with a gun is something that a lot of them pushed back on. Not necessarily, and we didn't survey directly about that in our questions, but in my interviews, you know, a lot of them said, we can't easily be replaced with someone carrying a gun. You can't just arm another adult and expect them to serve the same role.
Evie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Evie Blod is a reporter who covers school climate and child well-being for Education Week. She joined us to talk about a recent survey looking at how school resource officers feel about their work and how well their schools are prepared for school shootings and student safety in general. Now, President Trump's win in Wisconsin 2 years ago surprised a lot of people, maybe no one more than Wisconsin Democrats. It's the first time the state went for a Republican presidential nominee in more than 3 decades, and our next guest says the loss left the party shell-shocked. Fast forward to 2018, the party's mood has started to recover with talk of a possible blue wave and a few early indicators of an enthusiastic Democratic base. David Siders is a national political correspondent with Politico. In a recent piece, he talked to close to 24 party officials, candidates, and operatives about the party's strategy for this year's midterms and their hopes for 2020. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Will you start your piece with that upset win of President Trump nationally, of course, and here in Wisconsin in 2016? Can you talk about the mood of Wisconsin Democrats after that?
Well, I think it was just so deeply felt there. You know, Wisconsin had been teetering for a while. As you know, Scott Walker was elected 3 times in that state. And I think there were always signs of conservative strength there. But in a presidential election, it had been forever since it had turned. And so I think there was a lot of shock. And afterwards, a lot of reckoning among Democrats, you know, blame about Hillary Clinton and how much time she did or didn't spend in the state. And then also, as in the rest of the country, but, you know, Democrats looking at each other in places like Milwaukee and Madison and wondering what the heck was going wrong, you know, everywhere outside of the suburbs.
And you mentioned the presidential election year, and it seemed to be the pattern and I think maybe the attitude for Democrats. Okay, they're losing in the midterms, which that includes the governor's office, but they always have the presidential election year that seemed to bring out turnout for Democrats. And that 2016 really shook that for Democrats.
Well, that's right. It had been, what, since 1984, I think, that Wisconsin had gone for a Republican. So of the states that, you know, those kind of swing Midwest states, Wisconsin, I mean, Pennsylvania was big too, but Pennsylvania had gone for a Republican more recently than Wisconsin. Same with Michigan. So there was something special, I think, about Wisconsin, just like there is with your neighbor Minnesota, which, you know, went for Hillary Clinton, but Trump was within a couple of percentage points there, and now I think a lot of the focus is shifting, you know, to whether he might even be able to pick up Minnesota. So those, you know, Wisconsin in particular, I think, was viewed viewed as a Democratic stronghold for a presidential year anyway.
And now you've been talking to Democrats in 2018. What kind of things are you hearing from them about maybe what went wrong in 2016 and how they're trying to fix that in 2018?
Well, mostly I think they don't want to talk anymore about what went wrong in 2016. But there's definitely blame, I think, they cast on Hillary Clinton for not campaigning in the state. There were organizers in Wisconsin who'd been arguing that she should spend more time in the state, and that didn't happen. It's not clear that that would have tipped the scale. She had surrogates there, after all. And then for 18, you hear them, like everywhere, Democrats talk about enthusiasm, which polls suggest is real, that there's an enthusiasm gap with Democrats more energized about this midterm election than Republicans. And it'll be interesting to see what effect the Supreme Court, you know, the Kennedy retirement news has on that enthusiasm, especially in a state like yours where you have a senator up. So that's interesting. But I think the most important thing in Wisconsin is the money. There's millions of dollars pouring into that state from outside Democratic groups who are spending that money to register and get out voters. And I think that's what you look at is, well, you know, that's real investment as opposed to just enthusiasm. And it's paid off for Democrats. You've seen these special elections in Wisconsin where Democrats have made real gains. And so if you're an outside investor looking for a place to spend money, that's the kind of success you want to see is, you know, these big Trump districts flipping and a lot of money from outsiders being spent to do it.
Talking to David Siders, national political correspondent with Politico, talking about Democratic strategy, Democrats in Wisconsin hoping to make a comeback in 2018 and 2020. We'll be doing a similar conversation about Republicans in the next few days or maybe next week. That's not locked down yet. David, let's talk about party organization. I think it's conventional wisdom, and I think most people agree, Republicans in the state seem to be better organized as a political party for their ground game as well than Democrats. I've seen some people sympathetic to Democrats saying they'd put a lot of faith in public employee unions in particular to do a lot of the work of the party for them. That has changed. Their ability to do that has gone down, and the Democrats haven't really filled the gaps. Is that something you're hearing from Democrats this year?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the Walker organization is recognized nationally as one of the GOP's best state-level organizations in the country. And so if you're a Democrat in Wisconsin, that's a tall lift to compete with. And I think, you know, since 2016, the party is trying to do that. The state party hired an organizing director early last year, which was unusual or maybe unprecedented for Democrats there in an off-cycle year. And then they've added, you know, half dozen or more, or they added, rather, a half dozen or more staffers right away, and now they have, I think, more than a couple dozen people statewide who are working on the midterms in preparation for 2020. So there's an effort by the state party to try to match what Walker has going in Wisconsin, and then you add to that this outside money and candidate organizing, and I think they think they have a level shot.
A wrap on President Obama was that he had this great high-tech outreach campaign for his presidential elections, and that helped Democrats each time he ran. And he didn't really translate that into something that would help state and local candidates and parties. Is that something you heard here in the state?
Yeah, it was definitely a wrap on him and on the DNC as well, the National Committee. And the National Committee has taken, you know, Obama is just now stepping into the midterms. You see him doing a couple of fundraisers. I think he has one in Los Angeles later this week and then maybe San Francisco. So he's kind of edging back into engagement with raising money for the midterms after really being quiet for quite a long time. But the DNC made moves more quickly, and they started allocating money to these state parties to try to do this kind of maintenance-level organizing in non-presidential years. And the money's not a ton, but I think it's been appreciated by state parties.
There's the old Will Rogers quote, something like, "I don't belong to an organized political party, I'm a Democrat." Do you get a sense of that, like, Democrats feeling like, hey, we're really not functioning like we should be?
I think after the presidential, you definitely did. I mean, there was so much angst in Wisconsin. But at least, and forgive me, I grew up in Minnesota. I now live in Los Angeles. I can't pretend to be a, you know, have my finger on the pulse of what it means to be a Democrat in Wisconsin. But from the time I spent there talking with folks, I do get a sense that it's a more optimistic mood and a more a unified feeling, I think, among Democrats, certainly than they had after the presidential loss.
You also talked to some Republicans as part of this story you did. Governor Walker has sounded the alarm after the special election results you mentioned. But in talking to Republicans, are they saying, hey, we've been doing pretty good here. We got a good ground game. We're not so worried?
No, Republicans are very concerned. I think there's two reasons for them to publicly say they're very concerned. One is that it's honest. It's reflected in the polls. That there is an enthusiasm gap. Republicans have taken some significant losses early in these special elections. So it would be silly, I think, for them to look at the landscape and say they don't have a problem. They do. The other reason they want to say that we have a problem and we're concerned about it is it signals to donors that they need help. And I think that's been important for them. You see Scott Walker volunteering on Twitter that, you know, this is a wake-up call, he'll say, or after a special election or he'll point out these deficiencies, I think, and the reason for doing that is so that Republicans don't become complacent in the midterm.
How does President Trump factor into all of this? He overturned, I think, whether you like him or not, he overturned a lot of expectations in 2016. Did you hear party insiders on either or both sides talking about his role in the 2018 midterms?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think just like everybody else, Trump will factor heavily in elections in some areas of the state, and in others, you'll see both Republicans and Democrats try not to bring him up so much to make it a more localized election. I think they're out of luck. I think this is going to be a nationalized election. It already is. Your special elections have already taken on national coloring. It's a midterm election. It's going to be a referendum on Trump, and I think it'll be front and center.
Talking to David Siders, national political correspondent with Politico, looking at his reporting, looking at Wisconsin Democrats and their strategy for this year's midterms, and looking ahead to 2020 and the presidential election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a Democrat here in Wisconsin? Are you seeing this enthusiasm gap? Do you think your party is more engaged? And do you see that happening, that affecting organization here in the state and campaign activity? If you're a Republican, are you worried about losing a lot of the gains your party has made over the years? If you're watching from the middle, if there is such a thing anymore, what do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with David Siders from Politico about Wisconsin Democrats' strategy going into 2018 and 2020. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a Democrat in Wisconsin, what do you think your party's message should be? What do you want to hear your candidates talking about? Should they be talking about President Trump? Should they be talking about local issues? What? How about Republicans? Are you worried about the Democrats making gains this year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. John is with us in Janesville. John, hi.
How are you doing?
Good. What do you think?
With the things that's been going on lately, with Trump bullying people and stuff, and doing the tax break that was for the supposed to be the middle class, but it ended up being for the rich, and then with Paul Ryan trying to get rid of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, I used to vote for who I thought was the best person for the position, but this year this fall, I'm going to vote just straight Democrat.
John, thanks a lot for the call. I know political scientists argue over that, voting for the person or the party issue, David. But this is at least one voter who says what he's seeing from President Trump and fellow Republicans locks him in as a Democratic voter this year.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think it's so interesting what, John, what you point out is the your concerns that are, did I hear issues about the economy and health care? I think I heard that, and not for example, Russia or the Supreme Court. And I think that's interesting, and it's certainly what the Democrats hope folks are voting on in November.
Thanks for that call, John. For Democratic strategy, I think one thought might be if people already are worried about President Trump and don't like President Trump, Democrats really don't need to remind them. And they have the luxury of turning to those other more basic issues. They're probably not going to sway people who haven't already made up their mind about President Trump.
I think that's right. And I think 2016, if they didn't know beforehand, was the indicator that running against Trump or singularly running against Trump is not going to work. Now, one problem they have, at least in the midterms, is that the broad economic numbers are still very good. Unemployment in important states is still low. Stock market's in relatively good shape. So that's I think you see a real push, or you will see a returned push, rather, to healthcare as something that they say, this is driving up your individual costs, even if the overall economic indicators are relatively positive.
Let's go to another caller now. Joanne is with us in Milwaukee. Joanne, hi.
Hi. I have a question and comment. With the possibility of the Democratic National Convention coming to Milwaukee in 2020, what do you think that's going to do on people's minds, do to people's minds? And do you think Donald Trump is going to try and undermine that effort?
Joanne, thanks for the call. David, does having a convention in a state, you think, help at least rally enthusiasm for voters in that state?
I don't know, Joanne. I think it'll definitely improve beer sales in Milwaukee. And I know folks are really excited about it. The contingent from Milwaukee that's been advocating at these Democratic meetings is just, it's really enthusiastic. And definitely, they have a desire. I think there's mixed opinion about whether a convention in a state matters. And historically, I think the answer is not so much. It's more important that the convention be in a place with enough hotel rooms and enough transportation and whatnot. I don't think it has a strong endgame impact, especially since the Democrats are holding, they'll hold an earlier convention in 2020. It'll be in July.
Thanks for that call, Joanne. We'll go next to Tom in Green Bay. Tom, hi. Tom, are you there?
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, I was just thinking that I know a lot of people who are moderate that don't feel like they have a voice, that both parties have hijacked the radical elements, be it radical right or radical left, and maybe need a third party in America called the American Party, which is moderate and goes down the middle of the road, that does the most good for the most Americans. And we get these radical fringe voices off the airwaves. I know that doesn't sell commercials or news, but that's what's needed for the country.
Well, Tom, come election day, how do you make a decision then if you're worried about each party being, as you say, hijacked by the fringes?
I think that's the tough choice, because unless you get a guy like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and all these multi-billionaires to put their money behind a candidate that is not either one of the established parties, it'll never happen in this country. It runs on money, and people need to put money behind sanity, which is the middle of the road.
Tom, thanks for the call. Tom says he and people, not really excited about either party. Do you see kind of the polarization we see in politics and the media, David, just putting people off of politics, period?
Well, I see his frustration with polarization. I think, though, I would say that the electorate's had opportunities to elect more centrist candidates. Democrats picked Hillary Clinton as a more centrist Democrat than the alternative in that primary, Bernie Sanders. And in the Republican primary, there were John Kasich would have been a centrist choice, for example. There are centrist or more centrist candidates who run in these races. And I think it's, at least the evidence of 16 is that the electorate as a whole, well, maybe that's not even true, because Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote. I mean, she was probably a more centrist. Well, she was definitely more centrist than Bernie Sanders. And Trump, you have to say, is like, he was not Ted Cruz when he was running. Say whatever you will about him, his policies did not necessarily seem like far right wing policies on most issues, except for, say, immigration. So I think the electorate's been mixed, at least in its reaction to your caller there, or his whether it feels like he does.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to David Siders from Politico. He wrote about Wisconsin's Democratic primary, their strategy to try to make up lost ground in 2018. Back to your calls. Troy is with us in Muskego. Troy, hi.
Hello. Hello. I just want to, I'm a Democrat, but I was a big Bernie Sanders guy. So I just want to say that I think for Democrats to actually pull it off, they need to focus on two major things, which is, and these are things that when you talk to Republicans that are on the fence about, they actually, with even business owners, would probably support universal health care if they just focused on universal health care. And I think they really, really need to focus on wages and not just raising minimum wages, but just how minimum wages affect regular wages for, if someone's making 15, well, then the average wage should be about 25 to 30 bucks, especially in skilled trades. And I think they really need to focus on unemployment. The fact just because unemployment's down does not equate to the wages. It's just because our governor passed laws that made it harder for people to file unemployment. And that's the reason why those numbers are down.
David, Troy, thanks for the call. David, what are you hearing party insiders talk about on issues like and messaging around things like health care, wages, minimum wage, and that sort of thing?
I think Troy could be at home working for a Democratic candidate shop pretty much in any state around the country right now. One thing that his preferred candidate, Bernie, did get done in 16 and more recently is that while a lot of the Sanders-endorsed candidates have been flopping around the country in this midterm, the ideas or some of the ideas that he pushed really have gained traction. So Medicare for All is a pretty standard idea right now, and it wasn't 4 or 5 years ago. And the idea of higher wages, the $15 minimum wage at least, is now pretty standard in the Democratic Party and with candidates espousing that view. So I do think that there is going to be a renewed push by Democrats on health care and on wages. I think he's exactly right.
Troy, thanks for that call. David, there's a media narrative anyway that there's this disarray among Democrats between Bernie Sanders supporters like Troy and Hillary Clinton supporters, call it progressive versus moderate. People use different phrases. Talking to Wisconsin Democratic operatives and such, were they talking about that?
Yeah, well, I think there are still sharp divisions, and I think that there's still a lot of mistrust and frustration with the DNC. Just a couple of hours ago, the DNC, at least a committee of it, moved forward with a bid to, and they probably will adopt it, to reduce sharply the influence of superdelegates at the convention. And they're taking these kind of measures, that, and they're trying to limit caucuses, I think, and move to primaries to try to bridge that gap. And you've seen Bernie Sanders and others come out and praise that effort, but there are still lingering frustrations. And I think that's has been in the midterms a real problem and could be in the Democratic primary.
And David, briefly, do you get the sense that Wisconsin Democrats are optimistic about the big ticket items here, the race for governor and U.S. Senate?
Yeah, I mean, the electorates are all, like, voters are always, they're always optimistic. They always think that they have a shot. I think what gives credible reason to that optimism is the special election victories that Democrats have had this year and the amount of money being spent in the state. Now, I'm not saying that means they're going to win, at the top. And I think Tammy Baldwin, I think she probably has a tough race in front of her, and these other races as well. But I do think that there are credible reasons to think that the Democrats are riding the ship there.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David Siders, national political correspondent at Politico, talking to us about his recent piece titled "Shell-Shocked Democrats Regroup in Wisconsin."